However, I mustn't go on ahead too quickly. It's not so easy to start up something new, not so easy to start up a new spiritual movement, a new Buddhist organization, as one might think. In this connection, I'm reminded of a story about Voltaire, the great French writer and thinker. It's said that sometime in the middle of the 18th century, a young clergyman came to see Voltaire, a clergyman whose faith in the church, in Christianity, had evidently been crumbling. So he thought it would be a good idea to start a new religion. So Voltaire, being the great sage of the times, this young clergyman went to Voltaire and he asked him, "What should I do in order to start a new religion?" So Voltaire said, "It's very easy. You just have to do two things." He said, "First of all, you just get yourself crucified, and then you rise from the dead." So it isn't so easy to start a new religion as one might think. It isn't very easy even to start a new spiritual movement. It isn't easy to start a new Buddhist organization. It's not clear at first what has to be done. But I think I can say this from my own experience. It's usually quite clear at first how things are not to be done, even though it's not so clear how they are or they were to be done. One thing that was clear to me was that Buddhist organizations could not be run by non-Buddhists. They couldn't be run simply by people who are good at running organizations, however good, however efficient they might be. And they couldn't certainly be run by people who were merely after power or influence or name and fame. A Buddhist organization, it was clear, a Buddhist spiritual movement could be run only by Buddhists, could be run only by real Buddhists, could be run only by those who were actually committed to Buddhism, committed to the Dharma, who actually practiced the Buddha's teaching, not by those who had merely an intellectual interest in it. And strange to say, at the time, this did not seem to be generally realized. People seemed to think that a Buddhist organization actually could be run by non-Buddhists, that a spiritual movement could be run by people who were not themselves spiritually motivated. However, at that time it was clear to me that this was not so, that a spiritual movement could only be run by people who were spiritually motivated, that a Buddhist movement could be run only by Buddhists. But how could one know who was spiritually motivated? How could one know who was a Buddhist? What was a Buddhist, in fact, anyway? What was the criterion? Well, eventually the answer became clear. In fact, in a way, I'd known it all along. But now I saw it in a new light. A Buddhist is one who goes for refuge. One who goes for refuge, as we say, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. One who commits himself to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Commits himself to them with, as we say, body, speech, and mind. In other words, totally. And there are many examples of this sort of thing in the ancient Buddhist scriptures. When we read those scriptures, especially when we read the Pali scriptures, what do we find happening? Well, we encounter the Buddha. And the Buddha is wandering from place to place, begging his food as he goes. And in the course of his wanderings, in the course of his journeyings, he meets somebody.
under a tree or in a village.
And they get into conversation. They start talking. Maybe it's a Brahmin priest. Maybe it's a farmer. Maybe it's a well-to-do merchant or a young man about town. Maybe it's a wandering ascetic. Maybe it's a housewife. Maybe it's a prince. But in one way or another, they get into conversation, they get talking. And sooner or later, this particular person, the priest or the farmer, whoever it is, asks the Buddha a question. Perhaps he's impressed by the Buddha's appearance, so noble, so lofty. So he asks a question. He questions the Buddha about perhaps the meaning of life, or about his teaching, or what happens after death. And then the Buddha replies. The Buddha might reply at considerable length, giving a sort of detailed discourse. After all, in those days, they had plenty of time for such things. Or he might reply in just a few words. If he was very, very inspired, he might even reply in verse, breathing out what is called an udana. Or he might occasionally reply even with complete silence. He might not say anything at all, but that would be a communication. By saying nothing, he would say so much, there would be a wordless communication. And as I'm sure many of you know, it's from this wordless communication that the great Chan or Zen tradition originated. On the other hand, the Buddha might give one of his famous lion roars, or singhanadas, as they're called. That is to say, a full and frank, almost defiant declaration of his own great spiritual experience and the path that he taught. But whatsoever the Buddha did, whatsoever the Buddha said or did not say, in reply to the questioner's question, if that questioner, if that listener was receptive, the result was the same. He or she would feel deeply affected, deeply moved, deeply stirred, and sometimes there were external manifestations of this. Their hair might stand on end. They might even shed tears, or they might be seized by a violent fit of trembling. They were so stirred, so moved, so astonished, so thrilled. They'd feel perhaps completely overwhelmed, and they'd have a tremendous experience, an experience of illumination. It would be just like seeing a great light. They'd have a tremendous sense of freedom, of emancipation. They'd feel as though a great burden had been lifted from their back, or as though they'd been just suddenly let out of prison, or as though they could at last see their way. The questioner, the listener, would feel spiritually reborn, would feel like a new man. So at that great moment, that turning point in his life, what would that person say? What would be his response to the Buddha and his Dharma? What would be the cry that broke from his lips? Well, according to those ancient Pali texts, he'd say, Bhutang saranangacchami, Dhammang saranangacchami, Sanghang saranangacchami, which means, to the Buddha for refuge I go. To the Dharma for refuge I go. To the Sangha for refuge I go. And this would be his response. This is what he would say. He would go for refuge. He would commit himself. Because the vision that the Buddha has shown him, the vision of truth, the vision of existence, the vision of human life itself, in all this depth and complexity, was so great that all he could do was to give himself
to that vision completely. He'd want to live for that vision. He'd want, if necessary, to die for it. And this is how one could know who was a Buddhist. This was the criterion. A Buddhist is one who goes for refuge in that sort of way as his response to the Buddha and his teaching. A Buddhist is one who commits himself, gives himself, if you like, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So this was the criterion in the Buddha's day, 2,500 years ago, and it remains the criterion today.